Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Good evening. Good afternoon. Good evening. We're about to begin the show. Good evening. My name is David McKnight. I'm the director of the Rare Book and Manuscript Library in the Kislak Center for Rare Books, Special Collections, Rare Books and Manuscripts. And I'm also the chair of the ASW Rosenbach Lectures Committee. I would like to welcome you to the second lecture in the 2014 Rosenbach Lectures. Our lecturer is Harvard professor Anne Blair. As I mentioned in my introductory remarks last evening, the Rosenbach Lectures and Bibliography are co-sponsored by the Penn Libraries and the University of Pennsylvania Press. In selecting a Rosenbach lecturer, the library and the press share the goal of identifying an individual who has made or is making a significant contribution to the study of bibliography and the disciplines of authorship, reading, and publishing, framed often under the rubric of the history of the book or print. After selecting a Rosenbach lecturer, the library hopes that we will fill the seats in the class of 78 pavilion where you are this evening, and the press hopes that it will have a great manuscript for publication. No jinxing here. During the past several years, this has been a winning combination, press and library working together. Recent UPenn Press titles drawn from Rosenbach lectures include David Hall's Ways of Writing, The Practice and Politics of Text-Making in 17th Century New England, Elizabeth Eisenstein's Divine Art, Infernal Machine, The Reception of Printing in the West from First Impressions to the Sense of an Ending, and more recently, Alberto Manguel's The Traveler, The Tower, and The Worm, The Reader as Metaphor. Other recent lectures are on their way in book form as we speak. It is now my pleasure to introduce in his material form a man who needs no introduction, Professor Peter Stollybrough, Walter H. and Lenore C. Annenberg Professor in the Humanities and Professor of English and of Comparative Literature and Literary Theory. And Peter will introduce Anne Blair this evening. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure and privilege to introduce Anne Blair tonight. I do not want to repeat, even if I could, Roger Chartier's brilliant introduction last night, in which he emphasized the quite extraordinary significance of Anne's work, not just to early modern scholars, but to anyone interested in the construction and dissemination of knowledge from classical antiquity to the internet age. Instead, I want to explore very briefly the continuities between Anne's earlier work and the talks that she is giving this week on the scribes and secretaries, without whom the work of scholars would be inconceivable. Last night, in her lecture on Hidden Helpers, Anne reminded us of Stephen Chapin's invisible technicians, the laboratory workers who made experimental knowledge possible. But it is Anne herself who has done more than anyone to reveal the invisible technologies of knowledge production that published books usually conceal. Above all, she has made us understand the significance of the note-taking practices that were the crucial first stage in the construction and organization of knowledge in early modern Europe. How, for instance, did the great Renaissance encyclopedist Conrad Gessner set about compiling his massive works? As Anne shows, he started by cutting up previously printed works into slips and then organizing the slips by the subjects that he wanted to address. And this is one of Anne's slides. These are Anne's slides, I should say, stolen from various places. But you can see, this is the actual printer's copy. This is what the printer was working with. So this is other people's work that he's just cut out. He always bought two copies because you want the front and back side of the page. So you buy. And then you add in notes, you correct as you go along. So, this is the work that Anne has so brilliantly illuminated. In other words, Gessner started not from his own mind, but from the work of others, which in a perfectly standard humanist practice, he reworked for his own purposes, adding and revising by hand as necessary. Here, the hidden helpers, invisible in the final edition, are quite literally the other scholars whose work Gessner appropriates. But as Anne shows, cut-up pieces of paper could themselves be organised with the help of cabinet makers into elaborate filing systems. And this is one of my, let me go back, I've got them badly organised. This is a cabinetry. This is part of what Anne was talking about last night, the art of excerpting, you know, but here, if you organise the excerpts, and this is just a detail there, hanging them, I mean, Anne has got, it's hung on hooks, and so you've got the categories there, and you can add extra categories as you go along and put onto hooks. So this is the kind of project that Gessner is doing in his encyclopedic work. So in other words, the art of excerpting, which Anne so finely illuminated last night, could itself be supplemented by a filing technology that required a wide range of intellectual and manual skills other than those of the humanist scholar. At the beginning of her lectures, Anne used Antonello da Messina's great depiction of St. Jerome to reveal the extent to which the iconography of the solitary scholar occludes the technicians in writing and woodwork that Jerome's project required. Although I'd say actually the woodwork is pretty visible there, so it's actually a rather fine example of how you can see the wood. It is these, what you can see though, but while occluding the amanuenses, as Anne stressed last night, Antonio illuminates the marked up and annotated books that Anne has so brilliantly analysed in her work on Renaissance note-taking. In other words, I'm suggesting that this image faces both backwards towards Anne's earlier work, which it illuminates, at the same time that it occludes what she's going to be talking about. In other words, it's a study surrounded by books. And if you look at the actual books, you can see they're open, but I don't know if you can see this, they all have bookmarks coming out of them, hanging down. So this is precisely the area of commonplace, and he's actually making his commonplace, he's got his books all commonplace all around him. So they're suggesting this image faces both backwards to all the work that Anne's done, on that very history of how you go through books, that you don't start as a solitary, I mean, even when he looks solitary, he's actually surrounded by all of these other, the people he's been reading, and all he's already marked up. It is these marked up and annotated books from Penn's own collections that Anne will be talking about tomorrow in her seminar, here on the sixth floor, at 10 a.m. So people are welcome to come, but they should let us know, so we have some sense of how many people. So is that right? They should contact John Pollock, I think. Yeah. Yep. Back there. So John Pollock, if anyone doesn't know John, he's back there. And but
all are welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And on Thursday night, at 5:30 p.m., Anne will be giving her concluding lecture on authors and amanuenses. Tonight, though, she's going to be showing us the actual work that secretaries and scribes played in the making of texts. Please join me in welcoming Anne, who'll be talking this evening about hands and minds at work.
Super. Thanks so much. I'm having a blast being a part of your community. I feel I've been swept up into libraries, students, friends, new people I'm meeting, emails. I look forward to this evening very much. Thank you for coming. So yesterday, as Peter adumbrated a bit, I situated early modern amanuenses in a quick survey of sort of the representations of the practice, the representation and the practice of authorship from antiquity to 1800. Helpers are left out of representations of the work of authors and scholars, though they were routinely involved in intellectual work over the longue durée of pre- and early modern European scholarship. And the kinds of scribes who were depicted were the holy scribes responsible for writing the Bible and other sacred texts, taking dictation from the Holy Ghost or from John in the Byzantine tradition. Their work was perfect. Their depiction was, of course, modeled on that of ordinary scribes, and the latter only make an appearance, basically, in order to be criticized for their misbehavior. We had a scribe peeking in on Gregory when he shouldn't have, or in satirical representations of a learned man, like the one on the poster. And then only in the late 18th century did I find a few paintings representing principals with their intellectual helpers, either reading to them or taking dictation from the author. And I hypothesized in concluding that in the early modern period, amanuenses were actually more visible and perhaps less ubiquitous than in earlier periods. So I'd like to flesh that out a bit today and talk about specific examples of amanuenses and their work, drawing from a variety of contexts from 16th to roughly mid-17th century. And so it's not easy to, one gleans little bits, often from audience members like you, so I'm very grateful to have been able to accumulate as much as I have, but they are disparate contexts, which I'll try to flesh out adequately to draw out some general patterns. My first point is to note the variety in the expectations, the terms, the relationships between helper and helpee, which isn't a great term. So I'm going to use the actress category of the master, even though, of course, it implies a hierarchy that I'm trying to undermine, but that is, of course, how masters thought of it. So I'll use that term more than helpee. My second point is to illustrate the presence of two competing conceptions of intellectual work. And I do think print is changing the valence of handwriting in this period. One conception emphasizes that there are mechanical things, like copying, that were tedious, even perhaps detrimental to ingenium or talent, and therefore supposed to be delegated in order to focus, the author should focus on the liberal art of thinking, of writing, of composing. But another conception, present among many humanist pedagogues, is that emphasize the virtues of doing things oneself, in one's own hand. Autography offered control, privacy, mastery. In any case, this distinction between what's mechanical and what's liberal is never as clear-cut as in theory, and I'm going to try and show how they bleed into each other regularly. But the masters, of course, thought of amanuenses as mechanical extensions of themselves. The amanuenses had a rather different view. They saw themselves as contributing to an intellectual project. So first, what is an amanuensis, and how do I mean the term? There were many different terms in use, pretty much interchangeably, to describe helpers. So these terms aren't particularly associated with different tasks. Amanuensis, from the Latin servus a manu, as opposed to servus a pedibus, which would be someone who helps with their feet and therefore is a footman, a servus a manu helps with their hand. To be distinguished from ad manum, which is sort of a prêt à tout faire, someone who does anything. And a manu is, of course, a scribe. Comes into English, according to the OED, only in 1619. In the expression, an amanuensis to take my dictate, classic use. But in an 18th century lexicon, we find amanuensis defined with a much broader range of activities. In ancient times, their art consisted of speed writing, that exceptio, right? Not exceptio, but exceptio, seizing words on the fly. Today is called an amanuensis, a young studious person who helps out a learned man, who keeps his library in order, copies or excerpts something from him for him occasionally. And any other scribe can be called thus. So an amanuensis has good handwriting, however, and one term I've found emphasizes this, calligraphus a manu. Closely related in meaning is a cluster of terms for those who wrote, scriba, notarius, tabellarius, which connote a connection to letters especially. The tabellarius was a letter carrier, by extension a letter writer. Surveying the early modern English context in his invaluable Sir Philip Sidney and the Circulation of Manuscripts, Henry Woodhausen concludes that scrivener, first dated to the 14th century, and scribe, which appears only in 1530, were used interchangeably, even though today I think we associate scrivener with the legal and bureaucratic milieu especially. Penman is another synonym emerging in the 16th century. And then, as Peter mentioned, secretary is an important neighboring category, a keeper of secrets, and so closely connected with letter writing that in French, a secrétaire was a letter writing manual, in addition to being a person. A secretary, of course, was a title of many offices in church, government, corporate bodies, often honorific offices, which were held by appointees who did nothing, who delegated their work to their own secretaries, right? The secretary is a secretary. So I've steered clear of studying those kinds of offices and institutional settings. But I would like to include the secretaries employed by rich and powerful families and individuals to keep accounts, write and file letters, manage libraries, also tutor children. Woodhausen notes in England that secretary was an easy post to get and a hard one to keep. It was a common starting post for recent university graduates aspiring to become writers, and which often led them to positions of power, including being MP or Chancellor of the Realm. More broadly, helpers below the top-ranked households were called famuli, servant, which is a broad category describing not a specific function, but a status. And there's excellent recent work on early modern servants by Rafaela Sarti, among others, in social history, and Marcus Krajewski from media studies, shows how porous that category was before the 18th century. By the 18th century, servants were almost all the offspring of workers, artisans, merchants, or peasants, and the hierarchies within the servant status were increasingly marked by livery required of the lower ranks, the downstairs, whereas the upper servants, among them the secretaries, would wear their own clothes, or in fact, cast off from the master's clothes. And a servant could then move up the hierarchy within a household, or move up by shifting to a higher-ranking household in the same position. So that's 18th century heavily codified servant world. By contrast, until the mid-17th century at least, when this practice in England dies first, European families, even from the highest echelons, placed their adolescents as servants in other households of the same social milieu. So this practice of service as a phase of life blurred the social distinctions, because you'd have young gentlemen in service alongside servants, although the young gentlemen were passing through and were treated better than ordinary servants, typically by being placed in positions with proximity to the master. And of course, in this environment, proximity to the master is status. The master, of course, was supposed to impart lessons about life in their future station. The historiography on servants and the advice books of the time about servants, how to run a household, how to be a good servant, pay almost no attention to the intellectual helpers of interest to me, who clearly were a tiny fraction of the massive servant population. For example, the model of a great noble household offered in a French manual of 1692 lists one secretary among the 31 to 37 servants you should budget for. The recommended salary for the secretary was middling at 300 livres, on a par with the cook, below the master of stables at 400 livres, or the maître d'hôtel at 500, but above the valet at 200, or the porter at 100. And that, the porter, is a position so low that confraternities of servants in the 18th century tried to keep them out, claiming that they were really just jobbers, not proper servants. So in a scholarly household, we know something of what Thomas Hobbes paid his last amanuensis, James Weldon, because of accounts that Weldon kept. Weldon was apparently not a well-educated man, apparently did not know Latin or French, even though he took dictation and copied in these languages, as we learn from the letters that Hobbes sent along with the manuscript, warning the printer to have someone knowledgeable go over the text carefully. So Weldon's account books list gifts from Hobbes, totaling an average of £10 a year between 1672 and 79, which was a standard wage for a mid-level servant in a major household. I'm relying here on Noah Millstone, who's a nice book historically minded a scholar currently at Harvard. And he just also specified, for example, that the annual labor of an income would be about £3 in this environment, and that of a clergyman about £100. So at £10, we have a mid-level servant per year. Of course, he's probably getting room and board, too. Since my focus is on how intellectual work was done, I've used the term helper or amanuensis to encompass all those involved in aiding someone practice scholarship or authorship. And the social and intellectual range is tremendous. At the highest end, we have someone like Gabriel Harvey, who, sadly, we only have depicted by his arch enemy, Thomas Nast. So he's not looking great here. But he's a perfect example of the very well-educated gentleman, recently graduated from university, hired by the highest households in King England to read, take notes, and offer advice. Lisa Jardine and Anthony Grafton call him a professional reader. He read, annotated, summarized books like Livy's Histories, but then reflected, digested this material to draw lessons from them for the benefit of his employer, the Earl of Leicester. And here, sadly, in ruins is the castle, right, the grand dwelling that this happened in. In these cases, of course, what's being paid for is the expert judgment of the university graduate. And I don't think Gabriel Harvey was unique. Paul Hammer has studied, for example, the household of Robert Devereux, second Earl of Essex, who sought to hire, again, the best university graduates in order to delegate to them the task of expert judgment. In these cases, a high-ranking employer seeks the help of men who were social inferiors but offered exceptional intellectual skills and background. So the well-trained judgment of the university graduate is what you're getting. It's like a think tank as the model. And in this environment, A statesman like Burley, Chief Minister to Elizabeth I, was mocked for having about him, quote, none other than base pen clerks who can do nothing but write as they are bidden. In other words, he should get no respect because his amanuenses weren't highly educated independent thinkers. So that's one, the top of the line. By contrast, I'd like to talk a bit about 16th century Zurich. There was no aristocracy. Heinrich Bullinger, the chief reformer after the death of Zwingli, relied for support on a former student and family members. So we learned from his correspondence, thanks to Reinhard Bodenmann, the editor of this ongoing project, that one Christian Hochholzer, who studied in Zurich and Leipzig, and then became a pastor in Aarau, 50 kilometers west of Zurich, worked for his former teacher by mail. So in the Zurich library, we have manuscripts by Hochholzer. Here is a course that he took while a visiting student at Leipzig. He did most of his studying in Zurich, and Bullinger was one of his teachers. A classic dictated manuscript of commentaries. And then we see some of the work he did for Bullinger, which is to copy out from the Memorialibus of Bullinger, clean copies of commentaries. So I think this is Daniel. We have the beginning. We have the end. And sometimes he was delayed by his obligations in travel, as he apologized in one letter of July 1544. And maybe that's why in August 1544, when Bullinger wanted urgently to mail a copy of an important letter to a third party, he noted that the copy was made by his 10-year-old son, Heinrich. No mean feat, because the letter was a technical theological one spanning 10 pages in the modern edition. In this case, faithful copying was required, and the work could be checked by Bullinger. The crucial ingredient is trust. Bullinger needed to trust the copy was reliable, but of course he could do that himself. More importantly, then, he needs to trust that the copyist would not abuse his access to unpublished work. For example, by making additional copies and using, circulating, or printing those copies without authorization. And during this period of fast-flaring religious and political disputes, the reformers were especially careful about what they wrote, what circulated, how far. University of Zurich Library is full of manuscripts of things designed to be printed, which were withheld at the last minute out of some concern that it would ignite too much controversy. So what we see here is that Hochholzer was a trusted student. He actually probably did make personal copies, because this copy of his work is annotated by his son. I am the property of Samuel Hochholzer. So this is a personal copy, presumably, of Christian's passed on to his son, but with authorization by Heinrich, a trusted person. Obviously, a 10-year-old family member is particularly trustworthy. And there, too, the fact that we even know that it was made is probably because 10 years old was a very unusual age at which to be engaged in this kind of help. And I think the subtext is, look at my precocious child, when he puts this in his letter. But scholarly households often involve sons, nephews, grandsons. So here's just how Samuel Hochholzer probably added maybe a self-portrait. The scholarly household and its emergence in the Renaissance have been the object of excellent studies, for example, by Gadi Al-Ghazi, Deborah Harkness, Alex Cooper. As Gadi Al-Ghazi has emphasized, the scholarly household with wife and children was a new development in the early modern period. He identifies the 15th century as a time when rules on celibacy for university teachers were first loosened, except in Oxford and Cambridge, where they remained in force through the early modern period. Clerical marriage among Protestants also generated more married scholars, including Heinrich Bullinger, as did the emergence of courts, academies, other non-clerical institutions that supported scholarship. As was true in other lines of work, humanists typically married women from similar milieu and often trained their sons to follow in their footsteps, passing on books and manuscripts in addition to intangibles like habits of mind and values that Bourdieu includes in the Habitus. And these norms were enforced by senior members of the scholarly community. For example, Conrad Gessner in Zurich married too young and below his station in the eyes of his mentors in Zurich, and they punished him by denying him their support for desirable promotions that Gessner had expected. Gessner frequently complained about his meager salary as city physician, and after a while he also complained about his wife, and no son followed in his footsteps. But he also refers to amanuenses in the plural, so despite his tight finances, he used helpers, too. But in many cases, humanists replicated themselves successfully across generations. Yesterday, I mentioned the Vittori, grandfather, father, and son, grandson. and a changing cast of students. We also know about, of course, thanks to Tony Grafton, the Scaligers, a nicely double portrait possible, the Vossii. I could only get a portrait of Gerard, and I thought that wasn't fair to Isaac. The Casaubons, Isaac and Merrick, and many learned Theodore Swingers, three doctors plus two doctors, one theologian plus a Johannes Swinger who was rector of the university. The family obviously offered a generally safer and cheaper alternative to hiring outside help. But of course, family relations could be fraught in their own ways. Caroline Sherman gives us a vivid example of the learned Godefroy family, where the father, called abroad on a diplomatic mission for 4 years, tried to rely on his son to carry on his scholarly work on French ceremonial according to his precise instructions. But the son didn't take so well to being bossed and berated by his father by letter, and taking advantage of his father's absence, Denis Godefroy published the second volume of the Ceremonial Français according to his own lights. He changed the title from Ceremonial de France to Ceremonial Français. He added a dedication. Here it is by Theodore Godefroy. Here it is collected by Theodore Godefroy and published by Denis Godefroy. And a dedication is signed only by Denis. And he mentions not only his father as a helper, but also his younger brother, Leo. So the father is definitely getting demoted. And corresponding separately with both, and Billy an agent of information for us, is the amanuensis of the father, who manages the emotions of both men, as well as the mail back and forth, and so on. In addition to sons, nephews, and grandsons, wives and daughters also appear among the cast of helpers. For example, Abraham Ortelius gave to Philip II a colored map of the world that, quote, was painted by my maiden daughter, which is a reference I got from Maria Portuondo, who pointed out that this is the way to appeal to a puritanically minded prince. In other words, the maiden daughter isn't any old source of coloring here. Or there's the Maitland Quarto in the Pepys Library in Cambridge, which was the work of Mary Maitland, daughter of the Scottish Laird Richard Maitland, who collected and copied out her father's writing in an anthology that has become an important collection of Scottish poetry, and she also composed poetry herself, along with a couple of brothers. Wives usually feature in the writings of scholars as distractions from scholarship and articulators of domestic constraints. Even Thomas More, noted for his close relationship with his well-educated daughters, especially Margaret, in public at least, portrayed family life as business that constrained his time for study. So in the dedicatory epistle of his Utopia, More explained, "I leave to myself, I mean to my book, no time, for when I am come home, I must common with my wife, chat with my children, talk with my servants, all the which things I reckon and account as among business, for as much as they must of necessity be done, unless a man will be stranger in his own house." So he did it, but the book suffered. The same assumption that the household is a drag on productivity is visible in Vives's noting, Juan Luis Vives, this is, a contemporary of Erasmus, noting with happy surprise that, quote, "It has been more than 3 years since I have been married, and up until the present, thanks be to God, matrimony has not taken away a single hour of study from me." I don't know if that lasted. The ethos of omitting reference to one's family was made explicit by Erasmus when he scolded Vives, the very man, for talking about his parents and his printed works. He said it shows filial piety, but, quote, "Since human nature is malevolent, it's more effective to hear you praise people who mean nothing to you. So don't waste your praise on your family members." But Vives replied, "You say I mention family too freely, but Quintilian, Seneca, and Tacitus do it, and only three times, if I'm not mistaken, do I make mention of my family members. Twice about my mother, once about my mother-in-law." Which is interesting, there's up family, not down family, which don't get mentioned. Like amanuenses, wives appear to be complained about, and wives were often in tension with the husband's helpers. As Deborah Harkness has showed in her brilliant article on the household of John Dee, John's wife Jane was responsible for the smooth functioning of the household and resented her husband's natural philosophical helpers who were unruly, got drunk, set fire to things, prevented her from opening the house to visitors as would be normal, and most notoriously, in the case of Edward Kelly, insisted on wife swapping with his master, as purportedly called for by the angelic voices. Yeah. She was not a fan, but she went along with it, following her husband's wishes. More prosaically, wives resented the expenditures associated with their husband's paid associates. Daniel Magoshi has studied Jan Johnston in Poland, who published many large works, especially in natural history, and complained it was impossible for him to hire amanuenses, quote, "in part because as it is, I must somewhat neglect my medical practice on account of the work," and therefore cut his income, and in part because everything is dear here in Lesno, and our wives loudly complain that everything spent on books or the writing of books is a waste of money. So what Johnston is doing is writing to Samuel Hartlib, a Prussian emigre in London, who managed what Carol Powell has aptly called an information factory, corresponding hither and yon, putting manuscripts into print, whether or not the authors of them wanted it, circulating knowledge as fast as possible in order to bring about that Baconian reformation of knowledge. Johnston's hoping Hartlib will help him by providing copying help and finding him a dedicatee among those wealthy English aristocrats. But Hartlib was hard-pressed himself. He did a lot of copying himself, as Mark Greengrass estimates about 250,000 words, and he employed scribes at his own expense to copy works to send to others. 10, possibly 11 different unscribed hands have been found in his papers. So Johnston envied Hartlib, and Hartlib envied who? The guy who had it made. Marin Mersenne, quote, the whole cloister maintaining the charges. Right? Nothing can match the infrastructure of a Catholic order, where fellow clerics, well-educated, will serve as copyists, requiring no pay and no credit. And that infrastructure was generating large collective undertakings already in the 13th century, the Biblical Concordance of the Dominicans, the gigantic Speculum Maius, which is under the name of Vincent of Beauvais, but was clearly required an army of Dominicans under him. And in the 17th century, the Morris, the Bollandus, producing gigantic collections of medieval documents and antiquarian work. So there he is, Marin Mersenne, and a little teeny bit of left from the convent of the Minims. I forget what arrondissement that is, but we can look it up. So finally, that's the golden plum, and I don't actually have specific examples. They probably are specifically anonymous because they are just other clerics. Finally, another source of help in an early modern scholarly household was the practice, sometimes called a collegium, in which a professor lodged selected students in his home, who would thus share his meals and be available to help. Rather than being paid, these helpers probably would be paying for room, board, and tuition. Access to the learned man. Thanks to the work of Paul Grandler, Paul Nellis, and others, we know that this phenomenon extended broadly across Europe, from Italian to French and German universities, and was a site for extracurricular instruction, the kinds of things that survive only in student manuscripts that don't correspond at all to what the curriculum says you should be studying in 17th century Paris, which is Aristotle, Aristotle, and Aristotle, but actually they are getting New World geography, Copernican astronomy, chirography, Lullian mnemotechnics, all kinds of cool and slightly off-color things in private instruction. And so teachers outside the university could also engage in this arrangement. In his early days, after leaving his monastery, for example, Erasmus lived modestly on the income of two paying students, one Henri Nordhoff and an unnamed young man from Lübeck. Erasmus included students in his household later, too, though then they were not as essential to his income. But these kinds of arrangements are private and generally have not left good records. I do have one nice student-professor relationship that I'll talk about on Thursday from the case of Pierre de La Ramée and his longtime student then colleague, Nicolas de Nancel. We have one representation of such a collegium, thanks to Bill Clark's academic charisma, from the late 18th century, and Bill Clark points out that the professor is in a bathrobe at home, and the students are scattered around him in various levels of poses. You pay more to get a chair, and you probably pay more to be at the professor's table, or maybe he rotates them around. He sort of compares this to the opera, where even today, if there's an empty seat, you know, you don't sit in it because you haven't paid for it. Clearly, the boundaries between pupil, own offspring, and amanuensis were blurry throughout. These were typically young men, and they were expected to be grateful for access to the learned man. Who was paid and how much varied widely. And in fact, forms of payment for servants more generally were varied. An Italian manual on the employment of servants of 1589 notes that some servants were paid with board and clothing, some with salary too, some with salary only. Gozze, the author of this manual, also mentions an interesting kind of servant, quote, those who serve not for money or out of compulsion, but for mere and sincere pleasure, feeling great affection toward their master's virtue. These are called servants, but are not truly so. They are rather courtiers. And I think someone like Erasmus has that kind of, is running a little court around himself. It's an interesting analogy to think about. He He has droves of young men writing to him offering their services. And of course, Erasmus can use his stature as the most famous scholar of the day to his advantage, to perhaps not pay them all that well. Franz Gerler was the first to study in 1968, drawing mainly on Erasmus' correspondence, what he called the familia of Erasmus, using a metaphor of the Roman household, the extended group of people living under one roof. At first, Erasmus, so a Catholic cleric, he was released from his monastic vows, but Erasmus never married. At first, his household was a modest one, with those couple of students and a puer, a boy, to perform chores. After the adages propelled Erasmus to the front ranks of the international community, he could afford a nice house with a female housekeeper and an assortment of male family who copied, ran errands, worked with Erasmus. He reserved the term amanuensis for a selected few, his very favorites. Basically, the family got room and board and maybe some salary, but it seems that the reason to stay on was the potential for gifts. As OU studied already in 1944, Erasmus earned an excellent living once he was famous, after his time in Italy. He received gifts of patronage in money and kind, silver cups, gold clocks, silverware vases. This kind of stuff, of course, isn't easily shared with your amanuenses. But Erasmus, of course, could monetize those things, although he kept much of it, apparently. Erasmus made most of his money in lump sums then, from presenting copies of his work to important people, through the intermediary of well-placed friends who would optimize the circumstances of presentation. You have to know the mood of the ruler to catch him at a good moment so you get a good countergift, cash. And not surprising then, the best payments to helpers took the form of lump sums too. So Erasmus gave Quirinus Talesius 150 crowns in 1529 to thank him, quote, for several years of good service. And even long-gone family, like Charles Harst, who'd left, 30 years after, before Erasmus died, hoped to be remembered in Erasmus's will and was slightly disappointed not to be. So when Erasmus tried to lure back his favorite amanuensis, Gilbert Cousin, into his employ after he left for an ecclesiastical benefit, Erasmus promised him, "You will feel my generosity considerably more fully. And should he die, care would be taken that no small portion would come to you." But Cousin did not bite, and Cousin was not included in Erasmus's will, though his last amanuensis, Lambert Comans, was, with a nice lump sum of 200 florins. And we have the receipt from Lambert Comans for the cash. He actually, afterwards, I'll show you that too, asked for top-up, because he thought the exchange rate between gold, florin, and silver wasn't that good. I don't know if he got the top-up. Amanuenses could also make money on the side, especially when, as in the case with Erasmus, association with their master was a marketable commodity. Johann Koller, a satisfied dedicatee of one of Erasmus's many works, wrote to Erasmus in 1535 to thank him for dedicating his responsio to him. Quote, "I owe much on that account to your Gilbert Cousin, who suggested me to you. I will make sure to pay the debt I owe him." On the model of a court, then, the amanuensis was the gatekeeper to the important man and was the object of favors and gifts. But, as Koller's letter to amanuensis shows, proper courtier behavior kept the master informed, too. So, for example, we find in the Erasmus papers a receipt from Cousin acknowledging payment from Erasmus and promising to hand over any gift he might receive from one Augustinus, about whom I know nothing, sadly. So, Erasmus has paid him for that work, and if Augustinus coughs up money, Erasmus should get the money. And Cousin is signing his name that he would do that. And of course, if you capitalize on your association with Erasmus with excessive independence, it could get you into trouble. As happened with one servant, one Pierre Meghem, specifically referred to as the one-eyed man, whom Erasmus sent to Rome with a book to present to the Pope, but who instead spent 2 months wandering around Switzerland, begging on behalf of Erasmus and supporting the legitimacy of his claim by waving around the book. Until Erasmus found out, alerted by a correspondent, put a stop to it. But amazingly, the same one-eyed servant turns up again on a message mission 2 years later to England. So we get the sense that Erasmus can't really afford to fire even those he distrusts. He regularly voiced suspicion of various servants who he continued to employ nonetheless. A housekeeper and house servant who plotted to steal from his furniture and goods in Freiburg, but Erasmus felt they were too well connected locally to accuse them. Or Corinus Hagius, whom Erasmus suspected of embezzling money and then of turning servants against him. Or unnamed amanuenses who passed manuscripts on to printers without Erasmus's knowledge or consent. But what really incensed Erasmus more than anything was when a very trusted amanuensis, Nicholas Conius, visited while in Strasbourg one Gerard de Geldenhauer, who used to be a friend of Erasmus, but then fanned hostility toward Erasmus on religious grounds. And there, Erasmus had no mercy. He felt he was the object of a double betrayal from Geldenhauer, first, formerly a friend, and in a breach of trust he never forgave Canius, from Canius. Obviously, that tense context of religious conflict made Erasmus fear that evangelicals, as he put it in a letter, were trying to plant amanuenses as spies in his household to dig up dirt on him. And various of his correspondents tried to calm him down, you know, so Erasmus got a little paranoid over time. But he still lived with these people. So the impression I'd like to leave you with is of great variety and general informality of working arrangements and relationships, with little advanced negotiation, it would seem, on the conditions of work. So Weldon reported his income as gifts from Hobbes, and so too Erasmus's helpers seem to have been paid beyond room and board, which they're clearly getting, by gifts, which are unpredictable and entirely dependent on the master's decision. So Cousin's decision to leave was not surprising. Erasmus's promise of future generosity may have rung hollow in comparison with the regular church benefits. Amanuenses regularly moved on for marriage, like Harfst, there are no married amanuenses, or for careers, like Cousin. And they could move to a similar position, as seems to have happened to Lambertus Cremons, the last one. And you see him here signing off. He is postremus, he's the last, postremus famulus, the last servant of Erasmus. That's his claim to fame. And where he's writing from when he's asking for the top up here, he's writing from Louvain in the home of the professor of Hebrew there. And I'm closing in on who that man was. Ben Fisher of Towson University suggests it might be Andreas Baleno, who's in place in 1532. So the question is he still there in 1536 or 37? Any tips? Most welcome. But amanuenses weren't in it just for the money. They clearly derived career benefits from a stint of service with a notable scholar. They acquired skills, a good letter of recommendation if things went well, personal contacts. Erasmus warned Cousin that in leaving his service after 5 years, he was cutting short his education. So Erasmus was talking about everything that Cousin was learning from him. But Cousin had enough. He built quite handsomely in his career as a canon in his hometown of Nozeroy on the contacts he'd made with Erasmus. In Nozeroy, Cousin, so here he is representing himself in his Opera Omnia with his symbol, and he depicted his hometown with, on the map, his bibliotheca, his own personal library, where he ran a school, which was attended by sons of a number of Basel humanists, not too far away. Cousin published scads of short works, which he gathered in a 3-volume Opera Omnia printed by the Basel printer, Henrik Petri. And Cousin corresponded independently with associates of Erasmus. During Erasmus's lifetime, here he is writing to Amerbach in his own name, and interesting how he signs off, as your very small but most faithful and loving client. Right, so he is already perceiving himself to be in direct relationship with Amerbach. And then after Erasmus' death, he's corresponding with all that set of people. So Theodor Zwinger in Basel, here with Gessner, where he's promising to enclose a manuscript of Hugo of Saxo. Gessner, of course, is this frenetic bibliographer and compiler gathering materials. And this, the reference to this manuscript is made in a late edition after Gessner's death, of the Bibliotheca, the sequel to the Bibliotheca, and the manuscript that Cousin had sent is listed as being in the possession of Caspar Wolff, who was Gessner's amanuensis and intellectual executor. So we can see how it all replicates itself. But his Opera Omnia, and here, interestingly, this is Gessner, speaks to, as Peter showed a piece of Gessner's work, this is the backside of that letter, which has the address in Cousin's nice hand to Conrad Gessner. And this is what Gessner's done to it. He's drafted a letter of his own, right? So he's reusing it. And it ends up in the Gessner Nachlass, which is wonderful, full of these scraps and bits extraordinary, hard to figure out exactly what's going on. Things didn't end so well for Cousin, who was arrested on suspicion of Lutheran sympathies, jailed, although his name was cleared, he died in jail. And his Opera Omnia were banned, you can see, Damnatus Concilio Tridentino. Nonetheless, it's clear that he really got a lot of mileage out of his time with Erasmus. And I have one other example of this. An 18th century biographer notes that one Antoine Agara, by whom I've not found much, gained from working as Gassendi's secretary, Pierre Gassendi. He, quote, profited from the lights of the able master to become one of the first mathematicians and astronomers of the kingdom after the death of the famous philosopher. And you kind of get a sense that he undeservedly ran on the master's coattails there. So being an amanuensis was an especially valuable step up for young men working for older men, as in the case of Cousin and Erasmus. And the position of last amanuensis was especially powerful. The amanuensis in place at the time of death had most immediate access to unpublished papers. William Raleigh was chaplain to Francis Bacon, as Angus Vine explained to me, one of three chaplains Bacon was allowed because of his high station, who served in practice as an amanuensis, responsible for publishing crucial posthumous works like the New Atlantis, the Silva Silvarum. Ulisse Aldrovandi, professor of medicine at Bologna, was succeeded in his position by Johannes Cornelius Utterweer, who also was the inheritor of Aldrovandi's library and museum, and who edited from his papers two posthumous volumes. But family members were, of course, also positioned to manage the surviving papers. And we have Aldrovandi's wife, Francesca Aldrovandi, publishing posthumously a book on crustaceans, one of the, you know, Aldrovandi's many books of natural history of animals, one of the ones not yet published. And I've never seen this before. She is signing in her own name, as a woman, a dedication to the town council of Venice, of Bologna, very explicitly requesting patronage, reminding the town councilors of the endless labors and the great expense put up by her husband in his lifetime. Sometimes amanuensis and family worked well together. The Adversaria of Adrien Turneb in late 16th century Paris was published posthumously by the son, who thanks both his mother, whom he doesn't name, and his father's secretary, whom he does name, Ioannis Fordinus, for their help. But there was also potential for disagreement among amanuensis and family members. One Konrad Huber was the last amanuensis of the Strasbourg reformer Butzer, Martin Butzer, who had to leave for England from Strasbourg in the last years of his life, so he's dying in England, and along with another Famulus, Huber tried to gather up Butzer's papers after his death, but his widow sold them all before leaving England. They traded insults, the widow accusing the amanuensis of laziness, and they accused her of failing to appreciate the importance of the literary remains of the deceased. The trick here is that Vibrandus Butzer was on her third deceased great reformer husband. She had already been widowed from Ocolampad and Capito, and maybe she wasn't so impressed anymore. She basically married these 50-year-old reformers. She had 11 children, so she, no complaints from these guys if what they wanted was children, but and she saw them each through their deaths. So I sort of wrapped up a bit of the, you know, the material circumstances and the relationships behind this work. And now in the second part, I'd like to talk about the work that these helpers did. And this is a very different representation of Erasmus than the one we talked about yesterday. This is the quote-unquote self-portrait of Erasmus, right, which is commissioned by Erasmus, made by Holbein, which emphasizes the solitary man with his own work, etc. And so who is sponsoring this image? Not Erasmus, clearly, but Gilbert Cousin, who is depicted here as a young man of 25, I think it says, and Erasmus as a 70-year-old. This, of course, is a much later depiction. Erasmus died in 1536. This depiction is from a pamphlet of 1553, almost 20 years later, entitled The Picture of Erasmus with Gilbert Cousin, featuring Gilbert Cousin and his portrait and odes of praise to him, but also odes of praise to Erasmus, and which celebrates, basically, Cousin's coming out party as a humanist. He, because he published in 1552 two major Latin works. Here is a history of Burgundy, published in Basel, of course. That's where all his contacts are. And a work which I have never seen, but which, according to the booklet, the pamphlet, was published as an independent work, and it's called A Collection of Proverbs, which Erasmus did not include in his adages, with the exception of a few for which a variant reading and exposition are given. In other words, this is a supplement to Erasmus's adages. And it amounts to about 80 pages of the Opera Omnia, from which this title page is taken. So those are the two works, The History of Burgundy and the Supplement to the Adages, is what Cousin then is celebrating by publishing this booklet. The booklet survives in a copy. So first of all, there are copies of it, a variety, and one is online, which is great. And this one is a special interleaved annotated copy belonging to Cousin, where we can see, I don't know if he really thought he was going to get a second edition, he's using, I think, more as a scrapbook, where he's entering more odes of praise and things of his own composition, but also of others. You can see printed work in German stuck in there. So he is continuing to mull over how best to commemorate his time with Erasmus. This wasn't actually Cousin's first published work. He had already published a work on the office of the servant. In Latin first, I'm a little bit unclear. Ibo copy seems to think this is 1534, which strikes me as very early. But in any case, what's disappointing about this work is, as with most manuals about servants, which is very, this is a very early such manual, makes no mention of secretarial tasks, of the kinds of things that Cousin himself did. It's all about being honest and treating your servants well, and the servant behaving well toward the master, and not swearing, and not drinking, and not gambling, and not wenching, and so forth. Kind of predictable. But Cousin went on to publish a plethora of small works, which are principally about promoting himself. Collections of letters of his own, books on grammar, orations, a poem in which every word begins with P, etc. They are gathered in the Opera Omnia, which enumerates 48 different items, most of them previously published. And, of course, the Opera Omnia published in Basel. So to go back to the representation here, this, of course, is not necessarily realistic either. Rather than a satire, we have an idealization, and Cousin's idealization. Very egalitarian, right? You can see how they're both sitting in chairs. They're both wearing hats, although Erasmus is wearing fur. He's an old man, he may be more prone to cold, and of course he has more money. It's a study, wood panel study, just as Erasmus recommended to John Fisher when he was complaining in an early letter about being cold in his library. Erasmus said, you must have a wood panel library. And we think that this is dating, judging from the date of 1530, at that time Erasmus was living in this lovely house, rent-free. Freiburg and Breisgau had lured him there. He had to leave Basel. He didn't want to be associated with the Reformation in Basel. He wanted to prove his Catholicism. So he left for Freiburg. He probably dwelt in an upper story, rent-free at first, for the first 2 years that he was in Freiburg and Breisgau. But what Cousin really wanted, and Erasmus promises to give him, in that same letter where he offers him more money, he also says, "You will work less, and I will receive you like a friend, in keeping with your conception." In other words, as I understand it, Erasmus would give Cousin a more equal position, which is what Cousin had wanted all along. But that plea didn't work either. I think he probably didn't really expect that to be borne out. So the woodcut depicts Erasmus dictating, I think. Right? He's raising a hand, and we can see Cousin writing. Of course, its setup is perfect for dictation. It's not so perfect for working side by side in the same text. And here we have a poem underneath praising what Cousin did, which talks about, you painted the thirsty sheets to the dictation of the master. Cousin made indices, basically, of all the various things in the books of Erasmus. So we have taking dictation, gathering loci, indexing, which are the main textual activities in addition to copying, in which helpers engaged. And the theory behind it was that most of these were mechanical tasks, taking dictation, copying, indexing, and when a task required judgment, as in gathering loci, the theory was that the helper could be instructed to follow the direction of the master and use the master's judgment to stand in for him. And of course, amanuenses can also be useful for doing things the master couldn't do, like reading, writing, or speaking a foreign language. Erasmus apparently was not very polyglot, but his amanuenses were. Doing calculations, drawing. And those kinds of relationships are more of a division of labor. What interests me most is where there's a tension between something the master could do just as well, when does he delegate, and under what circumstances. So I want to step back a little bit and talk about what printing does to the status of handwriting. A larger historical perspective suggests that decisions about delegating writing became more complex in the early modern period. It was no longer unusual to write in your own hand, but it also wasn't unusual to use someone else. So there were really two options to choose from. In antiquity and the Middle Ages, the norm was to compose by dictation. Scribing was a kind of manual labor. We talked about how Bede noticed that he had done some scribing. Albert the Great is another who said that he had described copying in his own hand as an act of humility. In medieval Paris, university students were barred from spending too much time copying. Although they attended sermons, they were warned against wasting time in writing out sermons other than their own. Only one day a week might be spent in sermon writing. And these are similar, really, there are rules against taking dictation at the University of Paris. I think it's a waste of time. Petrarch was one of the first to articulate a preference for autograph composing, and he made multiple autograph copies of his own work to circulate because he didn't like those pesky scribes. And those first, the first century of humanists, the humanists loved to make themselves the copy of the long-lost text, perhaps because the original was too precious to entrust to someone else, or a broader distrust of the scribes whose errors and crabbed scripts they were on a mission to purge. After all, the humanists were famous for introducing a new script, the humanist script, which they thought was going back to the Roman times, but they really got stuck on the Carolingian Anschluss, which is a lovely script as far as we're concerned, but maybe if they'd chosen Visigothic, we would think that Visigothic script was easy to read and that the Carolingian Anschluss was very difficult to read. So there are conventions that are deep-seated in those early humanist decisions that then led to print and all the rest. So, but there's also probably for those first humanists the thrill of being the first. And we can find that at work even in the 17th century in the behavior of the English antiquarian Sir Simon Dewes, and I'm very grateful to Arnold Hunt for bringing this to my attention. Dewes recounts, as I think it was 1620s, how he began copying the Fleta, a 13th century legal text, from the exemplar in Robert Cotton's possession, in which doing, quote, "I took at this time also extraordinary content." But his pleasure was spoilt when he found out that, quote, "one Ralph Starkey had made the copies of the book common by his base nondonation or sale of them." So Dewes immediately stopped copying the text himself, and he had the rest written out by someone else for £1.19, by an able librarian whom I hired to perform it. If you're going to be the first to copy a 13th century text, great. If not, forget it. Right? So that's that thrill of being the first. Colette Sirat has also argued that once printing was a factor in raising the status of scribing, which was no longer simply a mechanism for making copies, but the scribes, so she argues that once printing threatened their livelihood, professional scribes promoted handwriting as a skill worthy of princes and scholars, and they successfully used printed manuals displaying their skills to enhance the prestige and visibility of their services. They argued, for example, not quite yet, they argued, for example, that, oh, I think I've got something out of order here. There we go. So here is an example of Juan de Iciar, lovely study by Jessica Berenbaum, where you can see a woodblock printing of all the different scripts that he's going to promise to teach you, and there are many pages of these. So it's using printing as a vehicle for boasting that a scribe can teach you how to have a beautiful handwriting. These manuals would boast that good handwriting would favorably predispose the recipient of your letters to its content, and bad handwriting, of course, was the opposite. One of the most ambitious claims for handwriting were those of the Basque Madariaga, who dedicated his manual to Philip II. He called handwriting a liberal art because it opened the way to higher disciplines, was an appropriate pursuit for gentlemen, along with fencing, swimming, and dancing. Penmanship, he said, should be given a place among the supreme accomplishments and inspired sciences, close to holy theology, since it was a divine gift and God himself was a scribe, having written in his own hand the tablets of the law he gave to Moses. So we're going to have to revisit those medieval descriptions. So God, we've got to have a picture of God writing the tablets himself. So of course the scribes were putting on the best display. They were helped in their agenda by humanist pedagogues like Erasmus and Vives, who that also portrayed handwriting as an essential personal skill, a valuable intellectual exercise. Early modern pedagogues talked about copying in itself is a tool for retaining material. Juan Luis Vives praised the practice of copying for keeping scabrous thoughts at bay. Those adolescent boys need to be kept in line. The Jesuit Francesco Sacchini cited the model of ancients who copied texts repeatedly only to retain them better. He reported, and I do not know with what veracity, that Demosthenes had copied Thucydides 8 times, and St. Jerome wrote many volumes in his own hand, not due to the weakness of his library, but out of desire to profit from the exercise. And we have a Puritan minister in the American colonies, Richard Steele, summing it up, 1682, the act of writing anything fixes it deeper in the mind. So writing is good in your own hand. Erasmus is, Erasmus is dubious. He's for and against it. On the one hand, he's critical of medieval writing. In former times, at the top of the quote, pupils at school had to take down so much longhand that boys wrote rapidly and with difficulty, constantly on the lookout for symbols and abbreviations to save time. So that's that bad medieval writing. We don't want that. We want good humanist hand. And in the same work, a bit later on, Erasmus is blaming printing for a decline of proper handwriting. Nowadays, the art of printing has led to the situation that some scholars do not write down anything at all, for if they decide to commit any of their lucubrations to paper, they write so beautifully they can't themselves read what they've written, and they need a secretary to read it and decipher but they cannot decipher themselves. So here the secretary is a fact paleographer better than the author himself at reading his own hand. And that's dumb. And then Erasmus is very critical. A letter that's a product of someone else's fingers hardly deserves the name. Secretaries import a great deal of their own. If you dictate verbatim, it's goodbye to your privacy. And so you disguise some things and suppress others in order to have avoid having an unwanted confidant. Hence, quite apart from the problem of the genuineness of the text, no open conversation with a friend is possible here. It's very easy to forge a signature, but very difficult to forge a complete letter. A man's handwriting, like his voice, has a special individual quality. So here, of course, we see Erasmus did write a lot in his own hand. And here we have, so first as the exception, is a scribal copy of a letter where Cousin explains at the bottom that Erasmus is feeling ill, and therefore he has used Cousin to write a letter to Amerbach. And the address is on the verso. Here we have Erasmus writing in his own hand both the letter and the address, again to Amerbach, his good friend. Here we have Erasmus writing a letter in his own hand, but Cousin has written the address. And you can always tell, of course, the amanuensis has good handwriting. That is, of course, one of the keys. When Erasmus is worried about changes made by amanuenses, he was writing in that particular quote in 1528. He didn't know it then, but in fact, the adages of 1526 had been the object of an interpolation by an amanuensis to which Erasmus refers in the preface of 1536. Quote, I had a certain secretary whose delight it was to weave something of his own into my writings, all unknown to me. I ask you, is this the work of an amanuensis or of a falsarius? Right, so Erasmus is constantly very suspicious about what's going on. James Daybell has studied the unwritten rules about autography in early modern England, when men and women were expected to answer a letter in their own hand, and the answer is when writing to friends and family, and when it was appropriate to rely on a scribe, basically as for business purposes, and when either writing up or down socially. In the cases where an autograph letter was expected, having an amanuensis who could pass off his own writing as yours was clearly a convenience. And we know about a number of scribes. We already described the case of one where the historians are confused about whose it is, whose hand it is. And clearly there are amanuenses who promised to master the master's hand. Amanuenses had already many hands, usually one italic, slower hand, considered more elegant, and the other a faster cursive, and they could perhaps pick up the master's style. And of course then, there becomes a suspicion of an amanuensis forging the master's hand, and there are a couple nice court cases that Henry Woodhausen alludes to. The loss of privacy through the presence of servants was also something contemporaries kept in mind. I have a nice 18th century example of Voltaire sending the servants out of the room before the conversation at Ferney gets irreligious beyond all bounds, saying, since I do not want to be robbed and have my throat slit this night by my servants, it's best that they not hear you. In other words, I want my servants to believe in God so that they won't commit atrocities. Richard Yeo estimates that John Locke, for example, probably kept his most delicate writings anonymous and secret from his amanuensis. So just as silent reading facilitates in the 13th century the rise of heresy, so too silent writing alone, does aid in the composition of risky works. Composition by dictation probably declined in the early modern period, but it also certainly persisted, and well into the modern period, the later Henry James or James Joyce are just a few famous modern authors to have composed by dictation. And of course, who knows how many people are using voice recognition software now. And certainly taking dictation was something that all Latin schoolboys learned to do, judging from class notes, marginal annotations, freestanding manuscripts that survived. And the best evidence of dictation is that there will be multiple copies with basically the same text with slight oral variations. Best known in the early modern period are cases of dictation due to a physical ailment. We've got Milton's blindness, Robert Boyle's eye troubles, Thomas Hobbes probably had Parkinson's disease, with a tremor. Other reasons, John Calvin liked to compose in bed, sometimes because he was ill, but also, it seems, as a preventive measure to ward off illness because he was a busy man. So dictation allowed one more freedom of position, and in a way, it's the ergonomic solution of the day. Right? And George Hoffman has argued convincingly that Montaigne composed by dictation using the variant readings due to stop press corrections in the essays. So how do you get from ville indice to ville indice? They mean completely different things, a small clue versus an evil vice. And it's not a kind of typo you'd make as a copyist. It's the kind of oral mistake. And so that's an interesting argument for the use of orality. It has occurred to me that with proofreading orally, you could actually introduce an error like that that would have to then be corrected. So there are other places where orality enters than just composing by dictation. Nevertheless, I think it's a beautiful kind of evidence to keep in mind. So why then, despite barring physical necessity, did authors compose by dictation? And even in antiquity, dictation had its critics. Quintilian warned that dictated texts required more revision. Jerome worried that someone composing by dictation would be incited to speak whatever occurred to him for fear of falling silent while the secretary was waiting. Augustine noted that some matters were too delicate to be dictated to another. So the ancient complaints about lack of time and increased sense of urgency indicate dictation was considered a faster method of composing. But why? Because the one dictating has to wait for the one scribing to catch up after all. But I think it's the hesitations of composition that were more readily overcome because of the awareness of the scribe waiting on your word, and the temptations to revise had to be resisted. And then there's the claim that authors could dictate to more than one scribe. And I've seen that attributed to a bunch of people. I think I mentioned Aquinas, but also Julius Caesar, Catherine of Siena, Peter Ramus, and Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill, who's also noted for dictating at the compositor, straight to the compositor. So the first time he saw the text in writing was the galleys. And that's how he produced those multi-volume histories. Maurice Ashley studies that. Haste was a constant refrain of those late humanists who were constantly corresponding hither and yon, working to printers' deadlines. Erasmus makes many references to the speed with which he composed. He notes he could never follow Horace's advice to wait 9 years before publishing something. He delivered pages humid with ink to the printer. But Erasmus might have set his own record in the 12 days before the Frankfurt Fair of spring 1526, during which he read Luther's De Servo Arbitrio, 334 pages, and composed his own rebuttal of 156 pages, which the Froben print shop managed to print and distribute at the fair, 12 days. That unique feat of speed clearly required the careful collaboration of many helpers, and is beautifully told by Alexandre van Oostgaarden in his new book, Erasmus Typograph. So amanuenses, I think, were hired as a time saver, enabling the completion of more work faster. As a direct extension of the master, they didn't get independent credit for that. A kind of work that they did get credit for sometimes was indexing. So we have here a title page of a work of 1511. So this is an inner title page of the index, and you can see that it's by Sebastian von Zwiefalt, former amanuensis of, who was the amanuensis of Babel, the author of the work. And here is the title page of the work, his commentaries on the epistles, and here we have the index itself. And here we have a much later, Bayerlingk's Magnum Theatrum, index volume, a gigantic folio, and where the author of the index, one Caspar Princius, licentiate in theology, is named on the title page. Erasmus also worked on his index to the adages, along with his amanuensis of the day, Nicholas Canius, who isn't mentioned anywhere. But Erasmus, so the adages are sometimes just indexed mechanically here by first word, and sometimes in a much more thoughtful process under commonplace headings. You have to decide which adage belongs under which moral virtue and so forth. Alphabetizing was, of course, a key task of indexing. And as Peter has done the work for me already of explaining how Gessner recommended alphabetizing, through slips of paper, either manuscript or cutouts from printed books, and here we have from Gessner's Nachlass, slips of paper that he's going to cut out and alphabetize, written on one side only, and that then will be these loose things. He talks about a flower glue you can use until you want to glue them permanently into place, like a little post-it kind of glue, and then you glue them permanently, and you ship the glued slips on pages straight to the printer, who then saves you the whole need to copy it out once again. So this process of alphabetizing slips of paper was definitely something considered mechanical and delegated. In particular, so here we have Gessner's Kaspar Wolf, his amanuensis and intellectual executor, preparing for print slips of paper under headings of medical ailments. Of course, it didn't get printed, which is why they survived. Here we have Ulisse Aldrovandi, who left literally hundreds of volumes, many of which comprise slips of paper glued into place. And Ulisse Aldrovandi thanks his wife, we now know her name, Francesca, for gluing, for putting together his five-volume lexicon of inanimate things. She probably also helped copy excerpts from authorities, adding up to her husband's 64-volume manuscript, the Pandekion epistemonikon. In 1664, the Spanish theologian and abundant author Carmula y Lobkowitz describes procedures like Gessner's for indexing, and he notes explicitly how the work should be delegated. Have someone cut up the sheets with scissors into slips. Have someone do this, I say. Do not do it yourself. Indeed, this work is mechanical. Then call 4 or 6 servants or friends and have them distribute the slips by letter on large tables. That's how you alphabetize. So helpers were engaged in a range of tasks where they were expected to make decisions in conformity with the judgment of the master. And this then gets into the more blurry zone where you're asking the helper to use his judgment, but to shape the judgment. Letter writing, for example, could involve a mechanical act of making a clean copy, or it could involve composing a letter on more or less detailed instructions, as James Daybell notes in his study. And that method of working was invoked in that case I mentioned yesterday about Bernard of Clairvaux blaming his scribe for an excessively sharply worded letter, saying that the scribe had misrepresented his meaning. Of course, it may be a case of just, you know, declining to take responsibility for something, or it really was something that, in any case, the way this is represented indicates that the scribe can be reasonably expected to be fleshing out the master's meaning using his own judgment, and he got it wrong there. Similarly, note-taking could range from copying out passages that the master indicated. Boyle used to do this orally. When being read to, he would say, select that passage, mark it up, and then copy it out. Or the note-taker could actually, the amanuensis could decide what notes to select. Guarino da Verona, in the early 15th century, suggested that in studying, a young nobleman should hire a servant to copy out excerpts into his notebook, but the master would select the passages and dictate them. A 1599 letter to Fulk Greville, once attributed to Bacon but now thought to be written by the Earl of Essex, advises a new Cambridge student to hire, quote, 2 or 3 to gather for you, including possibly a friend. We see the blurring here between friends and paid helpers. But these people should be told to gather examples and arguments for a position or question of your own selection. The letter warns that one man's notes will little profit another because one man's conceit doth so much differ from another's, and also because bar the note itself because the bare note itself is nothing so much worth as the suggestion it gives the reader. A note is designed to trigger in the reader a memory of having read something, and if you didn't read it and take the note, then you've lost that trigger. Nonetheless, you still should hire gatherers. And for your collectors, they should, like laborers, bring stone, timber, mortar, and other necessaries to your building, but you should put them together and be the master workman yourself. So the master is in control, is the idea. The master's judgment is followed by others. In fact, Francis Bacon was skeptical that judgment could be delegated successfully, and so he recommended limiting that practice to unimportant material. Some books may be read by deputy and extracts made of them by others, but that would be only the less important arguments and the meaner sort of books. Drexel the Jesuit was also dubious about delegating judgment. He says, your own notes are the best notes. But some 50 years later, Daniel Georg Morhoff took a frankly positive attitude. He said, if you can afford it, you should employ learned amanuenses to whom to assign the task of taking notes, but who use your judgment in collecting them, as other very eminent men have done. Of course, he doesn't tell you how to do that, in fact. And probably the way you did that was to work closely with your amanuensis. Kevin Sharp has argued from the papers of Sir William Drake that he had success with his amanuensis. The 15 books, commonplace books in Drake's own hand are followed by 22 volumes of notes, mostly in another hand, but using similar headings, authors, and judgments, which suggests that Drake successfully conveyed to his amanuensis his methods of working and selecting, presumably by interacting regularly with him. For this brand of advice givers, delegation was acceptable, but on points of lesser importance or when judgment was closely supervised by the master. Finally, the classic task of amanuenses was copying. We remember Vettori III, who, writing in loge for his deceased grandfather, conceded that only he hired an amanuensis for making a clean copy for the printer. That is a virtue. All other forms of help are not a virtue, and he omitted them. So, of course, a clean copy for the printer was much appreciated, and we can see when it doesn't happen through the complaints in errata lists and prefaces about the crabbed handwriting and the unclear manuscript that the author gave us, and that's why there are errors in this book. Compositor's work was more expensive than scribe's work, and a poorly organized manuscript was hard to compose from, especially if more than one compositor was involved. So scribes would either be hired by authors or printers to make clean copies. Correcting a printed text for a new edition. So here we see a variety of manuscripts being prepared for print. This is Cousin with Erasmus's handwriting. Here is a book being revised. It's already in revised edition. It's being revised for another one that didn't happen, where we have corrections throughout in the hand of Nicholas Tanius and one major addition in the hand of Erasmus himself. So here you can see an addition by Tanius and here an addition by Erasmus. They're not facing pages. We can see preparing of a clean copy. So this would be something you'd hired out, someone who would make a nice graphic representation of a diagram. Okay, so these are the kinds of things that an amanuensis would do to prepare something for the press. Copying, of course, has been much studied. Medieval scribes are famous for their tendency and willingness to introduce changes, sometimes unintentional, skipped and repeated words and lines, scribos of various kinds, and also intentional ones, inserting glosses for clarity, changing something that obviously made no sense, and hence the principle of the lectio difficilior and the lectio brevior in looking for the best possible readings. The shorter thing is probably the more authentic. The more difficult thing to understand is probably the more authentic, because the scribe made it easier to understand in the transformation. So those errors of the amanuenses were a real phenomenon, and a justification, of course, for the humanists to have a heyday, a field day, making corrections and overcorrections, and competing with one another and complaining about one another's corrections and so forth. Thank goodness for those amanuenses. But recent work by Daniel Wakelin has also highlighted scribal efforts in certain environments at invariance, too, in some late medieval contexts. And, of course, early modern copyists prompted complaints, as we know, about being slow, lazy, expensive, and unfaithful. So from the master's perspective, copying was mechanical, and any departure from that was a cause for concern. But from the copyist's perspective, it was an intellectual activity in which they fully engaged. We do have some reports of helpers copying a script without understanding it. Nicholas Wilding has a new book on Galileo's friend Sagredo, who would open surreptitiously intercepted manuscripts in Persian, Turkish, Arabic, and Chaldean and transcribe them without being able to understand those scripts at all. And famously, Milton's daughters reportedly read to their father in Latin and Greek without understanding. Of course, this is recounted posthumously and in an environment where it's kind of polemical what you make of Milton. So I don't think we have really good access to the daughters' perception of these events. But I'd like to close with an anecdote which illustrates the role that scribes could play in shaping the text they copied. And one of those passages tucked away in print brought to my attention by Jean Sayard because he had recently published an edition and translation of the De Recta Nominum Impositione of the French nobleman Pontus de Tillard. So here is the Chateau Pontus de Tillard in Bussy-sur-Flay, which I have never visited, but I hope to someday. By birth, he was a seigneur. He moved in the entourage of the court of Henry III, was appointed bishop of Chalon-sur-Saône in 1578, but resigned in 1594 to retire to his family lands and focus on scholarship, particularly etymology. And hence he wrote this book on the correct imposition of names, which is about the terms for natural historical things, quadrupeds, birds, and he's closing with gems and rocks. He mentions the magnet, the amethyst, which dispels drunkenness, and those strange stones that form inside the gullets of beasts. So we've got gallstones here from the Zurich Museum of Medicine and Pharmacy. We don't have a perdicite, which is a stone that forms in the gullet of a partridge. But he has a passage on this stone, and I will, with your forbearance, you can read along with me. I had retired to my castle of La Salle near the end of the summer 1591 with Philippe Robert, learned jurist and great connoisseur of Greek and Latin letters, who spent most of his day on his editions of Demosthenes and Isaiah, while I devoted myself to the study of Philo, that's the locus amoenus, right? Perfect setting. When one day, as evening was falling, Coumont, my secretary, came to us exulting. I have, my master, he said, looking at me, something that you could please add to your little book on the right imposition of names which you have given me to transcribe. Here is a perdicite, which I pulled out with my own fingers from the gullet of a partridge, which was served to us from the remains of your meal. And contemplating this kind of crystal of delicate transparency, which was of a size and shape that made it difficult to think that it could have been swallowed by such a small bird as a partridge, or that it could have formed naturally in it, I declared with surprise and doubt, come on, what game are you playing with us? And he, blushing a bit, excused himself. With all respect, I assure you that what I declared is the truth. If it isn't, master, henceforth do not believe me on any matter, divine or human. I split the gullet of that bird, came across the stone, and removed it myself from the neck of the bird which I then ate. Your chaplain, who's here in person, this valet, and all the other domestics who saw this with their own eyes, I can bring them before you if you'd like. I agreed, smiling. Give us your stone, I said. I believe you. You've convinced me. And I turned to Philippe Robert, and then he carried on a learned conversation about Aelianus and so forth. So what to make of this passage? We do catch a glimpse of something that happened, clearly. This account falls neatly into a type known to historians of early modern science and natural philosophy, in which the observation of an empiric, a mere merchant or fisherman, some person of low social standing, is adduced as evidence in a learned discussion. The detailed description of the circumstances, the naming of the source of the evidence of a respected witness, the initial skepticism of the master dispelled by the earnest protestations of the servant, are all classic strategies to underscore the validity of the account. Fontes de Thiers does not assert, though, a strong conclusion to be drawn here, but he does, in the margin, call it new. He says there's something new here. And what isn't intentional, of course, is the detail this passage provides on the place of a secretary in the household of a former bishop and a middling Burgundian nobleman. Comment, the name isn't unusual, not much to go on to identify the secretary. I've had no luck so far. He clearly took his meals with other domestics from the remains of the master's meal. We can infer he was asked to copy the text, whether a final copy or an intermediate stage, and he engaged with the content of what he was copying in Latin so as to feel he had something to contribute. It seems he worked in a space separate from the master and his guest, but near enough that he felt free to come find the master to share his observation. The secretary was considered a servant, despite no doubt being better educated than most domestics. His contribution of evidence is not the kind of a learned knowledge produced by the master, but the direct observation that anyone could have made. At the same time, the secretary was in the unique position of knowing the text that the master was writing and of explicitly requesting that his find be mentioned in it. In Thiers' account, Comment did not explicitly request to be mentioned by name, but presumably he was not unhappy with the outcome either, since, of course, he is in control of the final version, pretty much, since he's writing it up. So this episode encapsulates many of the points I've tried to make today. These relations were close, but hierarchical. They involved intellectual engagement of the helper alongside the master's expectation that he would be in control. The master typically thought of helpers as extensions of himself, doing work he could do but chose to delegate. The secretary, on the other hand, saw himself as contributing to the project that he was working on. Comment created an interpolation here, an addition, but an authorized one, which reaches print with the consent, slightly quizzical tone, of the author. So the account may have been tailored for printing, we don't exactly know, but it's a unique glimpse, really, into a moment, of something that happened. In the next lecture, I'd like to focus on how printing introduces special stresses into this relationship, what was credited, by whom, by offering special opportunities for thanks on the one hand and criticism on the other. But today, I look forward to your comments on this smorgasbord of examples. Thank you. Yes. That's a great question. There were other people who wanted to compile adages at this time, and Erasmus sort of got there first. The first adages are quite short, 1500. So they get very large in 1508. He famously worked in Aldus's print shop to see them through the press. I don't think we know about the slips. The slips and so forth, you find in Basel and Zurich. I found also slips there. And Ulisse Aldrovandi. Gessner is quite proud of his method of indexing as being new in 1548. But of course, cutting up from printed books is pretty extreme. He could have used, I doubt that Erasmus would have done that. And just for the record, Gessner, as you can see from his manuscripts, printed up from printed books, they were often used printed books. They were books that had been marked up to make a new edition and were on the cutting room floor of the print shop. So I don't think he's going out and buying new copies. Two, he mentioned he needs two. He's hoping he'd like to have a third because you might want to read the text again. But he's not actually cutting up new printed books, I think. But sorry, I don't have specifics.
Other questions?
Yes, sir. I'm wondering about the careers of these Amanuenses and the fears of their masters about them abusing the fact that it's unpublished work. My question is whether you have a sense that the skill sets that they develop as Amanuenses make them useful as composers in the printing business, and if you see
right. Interesting. I'm not aware of any. Clearly there are close relations between these people, but I don't know that the people make the move directly. So law training is a key formation for secretaries of many kinds, especially in England. So developing clerical skills is something you can get from university. And the compositors and so forth, obviously, they are often university trained. I mean, we should look at Tony Grafton's book on correctors specifically to try and find. Compositor is a very skilled task where you have to know what you're composing, obviously, but you also have to be able to estimate casting off, all that kind of stuff, how much space is going to be involved. It comes from experience, from doing it. I'm not sure that there was a hiring. I mean, obviously, Cousin, had something better, I think he felt. And once he got that ecclesiastical benefice, he wasn't going to think twice about leaving Erasmus, basically. Although he does write some letters saying, oh, I'm so sorry to be away from you. But yeah, right. He never came back.
But you mentioned also Erasmus' fear that somebody would plant his flag.
Yes.
Is there something that's going to publish or
plant? Right. That's an interesting idea. I think he was just more worried that these guys would go off and sell the manuscript, which is what Montaigne mentions. I won't take the profit away from this poor guy who stole my thing on armor, right? So it's just you get something and you make a double copy, right? You wouldn't just take the thing, although that clearly would happen to Montaigne, but you can make a separate copy and then you can go off. And certainly that did happen. Vanat Gerden is full of examples of, but then it's very difficult because Erasmus also uses that ploy. He says, oh, I never meant to publish that. So sometimes his hand probably is forced. Sometimes he claims it's forced in order to sort of, apologize for something having been done in a rush. And in a way, then one thing, and Tony Grafton suggested this to me, think of printing as almost like word processing. Some of these really abundant people who are constantly in print, constantly revising their work, are taking more and less responsibility at various times. And the first run could be something that you'd say, oh, it got away from me. I never wanted to print that. And then, but on the other hand, sometimes that did happen. Vanat Gerden estimates it really did. Someone did steal it. And then sometimes Erasmus decides lately to adopt it anyway, like his colloquies. He never meant to publish his colloquies. If we take all the front matter at their face value, but then he decides, oh, okay, sure, it was a hit, it was a smash hit. So sure, then I'll accept them. So the spying is really how this incredibly tense position Erasmus is in. Of basically seeming to be an evangelical sympathizer, but not, right? That's the whole pressure. He's not Protestant. He doesn't want to be taken as Protestant. And the evangelicals are angry at him for not having gone along, because he seemed to be. He was a reformist Catholic, but he didn't go all the way. So Luther hates his guts after a while. Luther at first is tight, hopes that Erasmus is going to come around. And that's why the spying is about the evangelicals who are going to try and stir up dirt on him. More about, maybe he drinks too much or does that help?
I just wanted to follow up. Is there, in terms of your argument, are you thinking about incorporating office furniture? In terms of what types of anti-theft devices do you find in the Erasmus? So we have this from a sense of viewers. And what about the ciphers in terms of trying to code something that you don't want to be published, but you want something, you want to hold on to it, so you're trying to write this with writing ciphers? So what's the office
for? Very cool. I would think that chests, would be the classic thing, and you'd lock them, and they'd be very heavy, so it was sort of hard to walk off with. I mean, accessing a horse and a carriage is obviously a huge piece of infrastructure, and so without that, your amanuensis isn't going to be able to get very far with your whole chest. But obviously, once it's open, then you could go in and dig out and so forth, and you've got to trust someone. You trust people with money a ton. All these errands, going to collect a gift for giving a counter, giving them a work and getting a counter gift. He's getting a certain amount of money, and there might be a letter saying how much money is coming back with the amanuensis, but of course the guy's got expenses along the way too. And so that's where embezzlement or legitimate expense, all this is very blurry, and Erasmus is kind of paranoid. I haven't seen any cipher. Obviously the Sagredo story worth Wilding, in Wilding's analysis, he may have some ciphers, but that's a great idea. And that's more for political purposes, I think. But you're right that the tension around this religious stuff is very high, and you can imagine them doing that. I think what's involved is really self-censorship. and paranoia. Those are the two manifestations that I see. I don't really see much in the way of successful anti-theft or, you know, out of the ordinary anti-theft device. This is a great, great thought. I'll look out for it more. Thank you. Very nice question. I've often wondered about cutting, and even at the print shop, you know, you never find uncut books in the early modern period. So obviously they had some pretty strong cutting devices. I know the pencil. Gessner is the first one to illustrate a pencil in the mid-16th century. But the scissor? When does the scissor come in? I don't know. Right. So early modern Europe has scissors.
Good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course, on your merchant pictures, we see scissors. But, of course, at the print shop, they've got something more serious,
yeah,
a big
yeah,
knife.
Yeah, they have.
So the glue, Conrad Gessner gives you a recipe for the non-permanent glue. The permanent glue they used was pretty good because the stuff's all very glued now. What other tools? So probably scissors, but knives obviously also. They have the knife ubiquitously for sharpening the quill and so on. And that would enable you to do fine things. Thank you.
Peter. I was really fascinated. I mean, it was a wonderful talk, but I was fascinated thinking about the notion of how much people are getting paid. Because when you say, I mean, it might be one way one could perhaps pool as for the enterprise. How much we know, you know, throughout Europe of how much, because it'll give you a notion of the range of different practices on manuscripts. Because I'm thinking that some of these artists stayed quite low. Compositors, as I recall, have stayed pretty much the same as bricklayers, I think, in London in 1600. So that we've often got an inflated notion of literacy. We tend to think of literacy as, you know, as having a special prestige, as opposed to being a very specific manual practice. And that's certainly how compositors are thought of, even though they can be very sophisticated.
Right.
And just one other area where you see that is also the relationship between artists and people who trace the drawings onto a woodblock.
Right.
And then the person who actually carves the woodblock.
Right.
In Plantin's account, nearly always the woodblocker, the person who carves it is paid much.
Right.
The artist is paid.
Yes. I have a great illustration of that for the next lecture from Fuchs's History of Plants,
yes.
Where he's got a very hierarchical depiction.
Absolutely.
Full page for image of the author. And then you've got the three guys. The two who do the drawing and the one who has a bigger one for the carving.
Yeah.
Now, about the compositor and the scribe, that goes back to the first question. So Woodhausen is my source on the idea that compositors are paid more than scribes, so which is just about how low scribes are, perhaps.
Yeah.
And, of course, but then that raised the question of why wouldn't a scribe graduate to being a compositor? But there may have been this idea that a compositor is quite mechanical. So it may be paid more, but like plumbers are paid quite nicely today in our economy, but, you know, they're not such a high prestige operation. And I think compositor might have had a bit of that. I have a very cool example, actually, I think of an epitaph to a compositor, probably paid for by Theodor Zwinger of the Teatro Milani Vitae, who is basically, you know, marking the death of a compositor on the job because it's the date of the publication of the work. And he says, to Daniel Ulhart, a compositor on the great Magnum Theatrum. So that's a very unusual glimpse of affection, of sort of solidarity, I suppose. He was a teammate. He was in this big group that published this 4.5 million word thing, you know, which obviously must have taken up the entirety of that print shop for a long time. So that your question in conjunction with Peter's brought that to mind. Sure.
More questions?
In relation to pay, I work with rural records from the 16th century, which are touched by notaries, who often complain that their pay And what they do, ones that I've been working with, is hold the records hostage until they get their back pay. I wondered what is punished for that.
Not yet. That sounds good. I mean, the problem is these guys are living in the master's house. They are a lot younger. They're, especially with Erasmus, I mean, they're trying to get something out of him. They want that letter of recommendation. They want the next step. So there's not a whole lot of pushback they can do, and that's why I'm actually impressed with Cousin just, see ya, you know. He did his time. He's got something better now. But they don't have a separate space. They don't have a separate chest, you know, that they could lock things in that Erasmus couldn't get at. And Erasmus can do them harm, which he already, because of course, what are they going to do but get another job in this whole network? And sometimes when Erasmus badmouths someone, he doesn't name them. He'll say, that monster. And then, you know, Alan, busy footnotes, we think it's this amanuensis. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
One more. I wonder if some of the difficulty in finding out even the pay of these or one reason for the rarity of mentions of scribes is that their tasks are mixed in with their tasks as servants in other sorts.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you have any idea how much the same people who are doing some of the cutting dish and some of the dictation are also doing the laundry and laying breakfast.
Yeah. Now, that's a great question. And clearly, when he gets a female housekeeper, and Erasmus complains a lot about her, she was apparently quite tough. Until then, obviously, these men are doing all the household chores. So the pu-air, you know, is drawing water, you know, all kinds of things like that. So it's sort of like a little mini monastic house, you know. But then he does get the female housekeeper, which obviously offloads some of that. But clearly, there's a lot of a whole range of work, some of it manual. I'm sure there's gathering of wood and certainly there's running of errands, lots of running of errands, which might involve 2 months, you know, sending so-and-so off to give a book to the Pope is obviously, you know, going to take a while, even if he doesn't start wandering around Switzerland, which obviously added to the travel time and expense. So, yeah, it's hard to see, but I think you're right. And of course, it's all mixed in because these are also things that the master does sometimes, too, right? So There's no clear, it's not a division of labor kind of situation. It's sort of a dynamic interaction. I can imagine, you know, one Emmanuel says take over for another, someone's sick, Erasmus does something when it really needs to be done or needs to be done right. Or so unfortunately, it's difficult. But that's a very good point. Thanks.
So much wonderful stuff to think about. And I sort of started to pick up a little bit of tension that you were alluding to between the sort of intense reliance on the scribe for scholarship and at least in the Erasmus household case, the fear of the scribe in the case of the letter situation. Now, I mean, Erasmus's household seems to be a truly interesting psychological cauldron there. He's not always, maybe the interesting counter example, but I still wondered if there a that tension always there? Is there a historical trajectory to it? Do you think it starts to emerge later, the rise of the autograph that we could talk a little bit about,
right,
meaning the decline of the scribe, and is there any sort of change over time there?
No, that's a great question. So much of this is like allergies, right? You know, how much of it is being able to detect them and being aware of them? And Erasmus's correspondence is an amazing window. I can imagine, you know, most minds are cauldrons, and then, you know, families are cauldrons, and then you add in, you know, your relation with people you work with constantly. Colleagues are cauldrons. You know, you have cauldrons going in all kinds of workplaces. So that would be an argument for saying there's always something like that going on. And what we just happened with Erasmus to be able to see it somewhat better, because he does, with his close friends like Amerbach, you know, spill his guts a bit about people whom he suspects and so forth, which of course is in his own hand, right? That's not a scribally made letter. He writes autographed letters about his amanuenses. Is there a trajectory? I mean, obviously, over time, presumably, people move out of the household. It becomes more paid help. And obviously, with Hochholzer and Bullinger, it's by mail. So it's not the same. I mean, obviously, he may be annoyed that, you know, Hochholzer isn't coughing up his Toppy has promised, he can't bully him, he can't make it to happen, so he bullies a 10-year-old to get it done. You know, so clearly there's some loss of control from at a distance, but on the other hand, too, it does simplify the relationship. And presumably he's getting paid, although I haven't seen evidence of that, but, you know, a messenger will go out with some money, or maybe there's an account in Zurich he can buy him books or something like that. So I would think that over time the big picture would be it's a more a fee-for-service, and this whole thing of the 18th century, you know, strong class barrier between servant and master, which would tend to erode. But on the other hand, any time you're going to have a secretary like Joyce and Beckett, I mean, you know, it's an intimate thing. You spend a lot of time, and obviously it's doing something you care about greatly. And so I can imagine that the cauldron-ness probably resurfaces, but it may be more contained. I don't know if that helps a bit. It's speculative, really.
Yeah, I have a question about the husband's background, his family, his education, and also how Erasmus came to hire these various
menuenses.
I mean, how did he find them? Do we have any sense of that?
That's a good point. And certainly in the correspondence, there's a lot of recommending of people and of asking for advice for people. Now, Cousin came from, he was the younger son of a large sort of middling family. So he was kind of, he was well-educated, he got a law degree, and, you know, basically sort of for first job out of university. I can't remember about how he was connected with Erasmus. But, you know, geographically, it's in the same basic milieu, and probably that may well be knowable. I should look into that. That's a good question. Thank you. More generally, I'd say it's all these other humanists recommending each other. And of course, people in situ, wherever you are. Some do, absolutely. I mean, there's still this tradition, which is very big in the Middle Ages, of students traveling all over Europe and of course, Latin makes this possible. You can study anywhere in Europe. Obviously, religion then becomes super important. And the kind of Protestantism, the kind of environment, so Basel is Protestant, but pretty loose. Because Erasmus comes back, after all. He'd rather be in Basel than in Freiburg, and he sort of feels like he's shown that he's not Protestant. And those would be the factors that would drive people to choose to work with someone. I think one thing that Erasmus claimed to be useful for Cousin was that he could vouch for Cousin's Catholicness. And, of course, after Erasmus' death, this became an issue for... So one of the problems is Erasmus does not want the reputation as a hotbed of evangelicals. Right? And so he's very concerned that his amanuenses, you know, toe the correct line. And he does not like that Canius has gone consorting with this Strasbourg evangelical who had turned against Erasmus. That's sort of the worst. After embezzlement, whatever, who cares? This is the true violation of trust. Yeah. Thank you. Well, I have a tidbit on Paracelsus for next time.
Okay.
But basically, Operinus, who becomes a printer in Basel, served as his amanuensis early in life and has some negative things to say about Paracelsus. But certainly these professors move around. Erasmus is constantly on the go. I mean, you know, he starts in Holland, he goes to England, he is in Rome, he goes to Basel, he goes to Strasbourg, he spends five years in Freiburg, comes back to Basel. They'll go where, and many people request his presence and hope that he'll come, but he doesn't. You know, then he's like picky about where he goes and sends a portrait of himself instead. So when you don't have, you know, when you're not Erasmus, you go where the job calls, where someone's willing to, you know, offer you, promise you rent-free house. In a nice house with a wood paneled library, and then you go, because that's your best bet.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. I'm going to volunteer a last question. Yes,
sir. Maybe one. Who's thinking whether the Latinized Cousin's name is called Master? Because it might suggest that it thinks that it might be paired up to summon. It's someone who's part of the family,
Well, of course, Cousin does mean cousin. In French, and cognatus means it doesn't, or it means in the family of, right? I think it's cousin who did it. I would think. But, you know, of course he's young. I don't know. Maybe he did it while in the ambit of Erasmus, because that's when he would have been, you know, sort of... We don't have anything that I'm aware of from before that time. We honestly have very little from that time. In fact, it's all in the Erasmus papers that we have Cousin stuff. But afterwards, of course, he's got his publications. That's a great point. You're very big on etymology. Well, I don't think I could muster a fourth. So.
No, send the contract.
Of course.